Hello, this is Janice, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 26th issue of the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Shutdown poses threat to Congress's spending power by David Morgan. Reuters. Washington. As Republicans and Democratic lawmakers trade blame for the U.S. government shutdown, some have begun to worry that the impasse is ceding their authority over federal spending to an increasingly assertive President Donald Trump. The White House, during the shutdown, has frozen billions of dollars in funds meant for Democratic-led jurisdictions, sought to lay off thousands of federal workers, and shifted money around to guarantee that military personnel and gun-carrying law enforcement officers will not see their pay disrupted. Nonpartisan observers said that further marginalizes Congress at a time when Trump is already pushing the boundaries of presidential power in other areas such as military action and international trade. That's like an existential threat for congressional power, said Molly Reynolds, a government expert at the nonpartisan Brookings Institution think tank. How do you negotiate a long-term spending deal, something that goes more than just a couple of weeks, when you don't believe the executive branch is going to implement whatever choice it is that you put into that law? The U.S. Constitution assigns the power of the purse of Congress and not the president. Trump's fellow Republicans narrowly control both the House of Representatives and the Senate. The shutdown began October 1. The first day of the 2026 federal fiscal year, because congressional Republicans and Democrats had failed to agree on legislation to fund government services. Democrats have said they will not vote to resume federal funding unless Congress also addresses health care subsidies for 24 million Americans due to expire at the end of the calendar year. Republicans have said Congress first must pass a temporary spending bill that would allow the government to reopen. Though Democrats have framed the fight over health care costs, some have said they are reluctant to spend a spending bill without assurances that Trump will not simply ignore it. We can't do an appropriations deal and have the president then just start firing more people and cutting programs, said Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia, told Reuters. Republicans often have remained silent this year as Trump has unilaterally raised tariffs, taken military action, and shifted spending, actions that typically would be the domain of Congress. Some Republicans said they understood the concerns raised by the Democrats. If I were the Democrats, I'd be requiring a lot of public commitment or statutory language to be sure that it is a hard commitment, Senator Thom Tillis, a Republican from North Carolina, said. Democrats have said Trump is overstepping his authority by making sure pay is not disrupted during the shutdown for military troops and immigration law enforcement officials, while letting other federal workers go unpaid. We want a bill that provides for fair payment to all of them, not just Trump's personal favorites, Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat Connecticut, said. White House Speaker Mike Johnson, R. Louisiana, keeping his chamber out of session and the Senate Democrats unwilling to support a temporary spending bill, Republicans are concerned that the shutdown is preventing Congress from passing the detailed spending bills that fund government agencies for the current fiscal year. It's damaging to Congress in general. We're not doing our job, and we need to start doing it, Republican Mike Simpson, R. Montana, said. We are running out of time. Simpson called the unilateral White House action to withholding spending unconstitutional. The current government shutdown is the second longest in U.S. history. ICE detainees report barely edible meals. Women allege reduced portions, horrible food. By Lauren Villagran, USA Today. Richwood, Louisiana. Months after leaving immigration detention, Camila Munoz can still remember the ice cream scoop used to ladle food onto plastic trays and the sour feeling after every meal. Hunger. You have to eat no matter what, or the night is going to get you, she told USA Today. We were really hungry. In Louisiana, a major hub of the Trump administration's mass deportation effort, detainees and their representatives say people in custody are going hungry on a diet of processed food that is barely edible, often expired and never filling. A week's menu served at Richwood in August, obtained by USA Today, offers a glimpse into the lives of detainees. Immigrant women and how they are fed. At Richwood Lockup, the breakfast scoop of oatmeal or powdered eggs isn't worth waking up for, they say. A ration of pasta with canned meat and canned green beans at lunch leaves them hungry. Sunday dinner, a thin slice of bologna between white bread and an ounce of potato chips isn't enough. Women detained long-term say they haven't had fresh fruit in months. Of the nearly 750 immigrant women being held here in August, according to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement data, 97% had no criminal record. Detained women say that among the humiliations they're subjected to, 1 hour of outdoor sunlight a day, backed up toilets, bug infestations, mildewed showers, packed dormitories, poor food is the hardest to stomach. And as the population at ICE detention centers increases, the quality and quantity of the food has deteriorated, immigrants and their representatives say. A Louisiana-based private contractor, LaSalle Corrections, runs the Richwood facility on behalf of ICE, with the town of Richmond as a contractual go-between. USA Today provided LaSalle and ICE with details of the allegations in writing. In an emailed response, Department of Homeland Security Tricia McLaughlin said ICE detainees are provided with proper meals and potable water following national detention standards. As ICE arrests and removes criminal illegal aliens and public safety threats from the U.S., the agency has worked diligently to obtain greater necessary detention space while avoiding overcrowding, she said. LaSalle Corrections spokesman Scott Sutterfield told USA Today, the Richwood facility strictly adheres to ICE detention standards and is monitored by ICE, on-site personnel, and the Department of Homeland Security. In addition, the Richwood facility is subject to a multi-level oversight and compliance program, which includes on-site compliance reviews, he said in an emailed response. LaSalle operates correctional facilities throughout Louisiana, Texas, and Georgia, according to its website. Food service issues aren't unique to Richwood or Louisiana detention. They are longstanding and predate the current Trump administration. A Government Accountability Office report released in May reviewed more than 240 ICE detention facility inspections nationwide and recorded more than 500 deficiencies related to food service. Immigration advocates worry the enforcement ramp-up this year is exacerbating the issues, including a diet they say weakens and sickens detainees. The goal is to keep people in there, feed them as cheaply as possible, said Lydia Pellet-Cobbs, an assistant professor at the University of Kentucky who has studied detention in Louisiana. That's why the food is terrible. These conditions of confinement might mirror what we're used to in prisons and jails and can sometimes be worse. Federal detention isn't supposed to be punishing. Immigration detention is civil, not criminal, and is not supposed to be punishing. ICE states so clearly on its detention management website. Detention is non-punitive. By law, immigrants may be detained while they await the outcome of their immigration proceedings or while they await their deportation, according to ICE's 2025 National Detention Standards. But detained immigrants aren't charged, convicted, or sentenced as in the criminal system. They don't know how long they'll be detained, whether they'll get to stay in the United States, or if they'll be sent to their native country. There are roughly 60,000 people in immigration detention nationwide in August and September, more than any time since the United States government interned some 120,000 people, the majority of Japanese descent or ancestry during World War II. The Trump administration has cut back on detention alternatives like ankle monitors, according to ICE data. The agency is instead holding people in jails, prisons, or tent encampments, the first and largest in the Fort Bliss military base in Texas, before deporting them. More people are spending weeks and months, not days, in detention, ICE data shows. Reports of poor quality food and detainees going hungry are not something new, said Satara Gandhari, advocacy director at Detention Watch Network, a nonprofit that advocates to end immigration detention. But it has intensified over the last few months. People are reporting to loved ones and lawyers that they don't have enough food, she said. I have heard them describe it as if they're starving. One woman tells of humiliating experience. Munoz was detained at Richmond from February to April. Another woman detained at Richmond shared her account of the food service with USA Today. Food is often served undercooked, like ice from the freezer, or overcooked and burned, said the woman, who requested anonymity, fearing retaliation. Everyone has problems with the restroom, stomach problems. The food was horrible from the beginning of her detention months ago, the woman said. But the quality and quantity have gotten worse as more and more detainees have arrived. She and other women look forward to Tuesday lunch. That's the one day they are fed a quarter chicken. That week, the Tuesday tray included broccoli, powdered mashed potatoes, and cookies. Then dinner, a scoop of rice, corn, two mini tortillas, and a scoop of canned apple. Other days are worse. Jars of jelly had crystallized. Beans sometimes smelled rancid. A slice of bologna still had ice on it from not being thawed. Mealtimes are always unpredictable, with breakfast as early as 4 a.m., lunch at 10 a.m., and dinner many hours later. She and other detainees and their representatives said, one day the menu was beans and sausage, but she was served only two sausage links when others were given a few more. I was so hungry that day because we were waiting for so long to eat, she said in her account, noting that mealtime often varied by hours. I asked the woman serving the food, can you give me more? The detainee, who has an administrative immigration violation but no criminal record, said being in detention was the first time in her life she's felt such a desperate need for more food. So desperate, she once found herself contemplating grabbing food from another's plate. It's so scary. I never thought in the world in the 21st century that I would feel that, to want to take someone else's food, she said. It's humiliating. Other detainees decry small portions, processed foods. Richwood's concertina wire fenced compound is tucked into a residential neighborhood in the town of Richmond, population 3,804. Inside, hundreds of women from around the world await deportation or a chance to see an immigration judge, sometimes for months. Like the woman who shared her August menu, other detainees in Richwood have shared similar complaints about deteriorating food quality with their lawyers and loved ones. LaSalle had, in fact, made a change to its food purchasing contract. Federal inspection reports listed Performance Food Service as the food services provider at Richwood in 2024. But a spokesman for the publicly traded company said its role was strictly limited to distribution. The company wasn't responsible for planning menus, preparing meals, or managing food services. What I can share is that the amount of product we provide to Richwood Correctional Facility has declined significantly this wood, said Scott Golden, Director of External Communications for Performance Food Service. That drop is tied to a decision by faculty management to transition to a lower-cost institutional food distributor, Shaver Foods, based in Arkansas. Shaver Foods didn't respond to an emailed request for commitment by USA Today. It bills itself online as the industry leader in low-cost institutional food distribution. Client complaints about the food began rising this year at Louisiana ICE detention centers, said Stephen Stanford, a Baton Rouge-based immigration attorney. His clients with diabetes and kidney disease have struggled to get the medically required meals they need at Richwood and other Louisiana detention centers, even though many had put in medical requests, he said. Nora Ahmed, legal director of the ACLU of Louisiana, said she started hearing this year that people were not getting enough food and that they were losing weight. Across facilities, I'm hearing there is not enough food, she said, and that the portions are smaller. The business cost of feeding federal detainees. Nationwide, detainee complaints to inspectors about small portions and hunger date to at least the early 2000s, according to Deidre Conlin and Nancy Heemstra, authors of a new book on immigration detention. Immigration Detention Incorporated, The Big Business of Locking Up Migrants. There is this incredible potential to make money by not giving even the small amount of food you have said you would deliver, she said. There is little motivation to deliver quality food. Bad food is the business model. The 2025 National Detention Standards don't list a calorie per day standard for food service. They do require each detention center hire a food service administrator to develop menu certified by a registered dietitian. The standard direct facilities to provide detainees with nutritious, attractively presented meals prepared and served in a sanitary and hygienic food service operation. The Richwood facility fulfills that mandate, Sutterfield said. It provides three daily meals approved by a registered dietitian in stacks. He added that Richwood's menu meet the U.S. recommended daily allowance guideline and accommodate special religious or dietary needs. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In May 2024, inspectors found that Richwood failed to post menus that met meal standards. The Department of Homeland Security's Office of Detention Oversight found the facility lacked the required common fare menu and menus certified as exceeding minimum daily nutritional requirements and meeting recommended daily allowances. An inspection 6 months later didn't find the same deficiency, suggesting LaSalle had solved the issue at that time. Hamstra and Conlin say there isn't enough genuine oversight over whether contractors consistently meet food standards. Inspections are often pre-announced, they say, and chronic detainee hunger is often dismissed by inspectors as long as the menus are certified as nutritionally adequate. What repeatedly happens is detainees complain, and then inspectors ask the facility operators what they're serving, Hamster says. They don't actually look at what is really being served. They take operators' word over detainees. Filling the gaps by working to buy commissary food. Munoz, the former detainee, said immigrant women can work in the cafeteria for $1 per day, overseen by LaSalle Corrections officers. Although the pay rate and immigration detention is the subject of ongoing litigation, it's one of a handful of jobs detainees can do to earn money they can spend on snack items at the commissary. A loaf of bread was $3, Munoz recalled. You could work for 3 days and it was affordable. Hamstra and Conlon argue that underfeeding the detainees drives them to spend more at the commissary if they can afford it. It's not uncommon that the commissary at immigration detention centers is run by a subsidiary of the same company that provides food service, they say. The company operating the commissary at Richwood, correct commissary, is registered to the same address as the company that owns and operates the jail, LaSalle, according to Louisiana Secretary of State records. Munoz said she felt lucky to have access to commissary snacks, thanks to money sent from her American husband. But it didn't make mealtimes any less stressful. She would calculate where to sit at every meal, knowing who wouldn't eat this or that and might share, even though sharing was against the rules. She gave up her sausages to Vietnamese detainees, and they would give her their cornbread, she said. With time, you get smart and wise, she said. We didn't know each other's language. None of us knew when we were deported. That's what connected us. Camille Munoz sketched this picture of herself in an ICE detention center. The former detainee said she can still remember the scoop used to ladle food onto plastic trays and the sour feeling after every meal. Teachers sue over payroll problems. Rochester Union points to district's new system. Caria Weaver wrote this. Rochester Democrat and Chronicle USA Today Network. A lawsuit against the Rochester City School District has been filed by the Rochester Teachers Association on October 17th due to ongoing payroll issues. The problem started when the district transitioned on July 2nd from PeopleSoft to Oracle, a platform that supports the district's financial, human capital, and technology operations. When the issues first began, the district released a statement in August outlining how it was addressing each situation individually and was working to resolve all matters promptly while preventing future discrepancies and disruptions. Before the lawsuit was filed, RCSD declined to comment on RTA's intent to pursue litigation, but said the district is focusing on addressing payroll problems at hand. The Democrat and Chronicle reached out to the district for an updated statement and is awaiting a response. RCSD payroll issues. Adam Urbanski, president of the Rochester Teachers Association, said in a statement how issues have not been resolved, which have resulted in teachers not getting paid or experiencing delayed pay, inaccurate pay, wrongful deductions, and other payroll-related errors. Urbanski contacted the New York State United Teachers to have its attorneys prepare a lawsuit against the Rochester District. The lawsuit accuses the district of violating a core tenet of the employer-employee relationship and failing to pay employees accurately and timely. The litigation also describes the impact of these issues on RTA members. RTA has also involved the Department of Labor and the New York State Comptroller to take action on the matter. According to Urbanski, the New York State Comptroller's Office notified the district that the matter merits immediate attention and demanded detailed accounting, data on the scope of harm, and remediation steps. Shipbuilders, ports, hit an assault on offshore wind. Trump's attacks on tech create uncertain future. Nicola Groom for Reuters. There's a photo showing rotor blades and other parts for the construction of the Revolution Wind project are staged in New London, Connecticut on September 23rd. Offshore winds rise in the Northeast had fueled robust demand for vessels. U.S. shipbuilders and port operators are getting hit in the fallout from President Donald Trump's campaign to wipe out the offshore wind industry, suffering hundreds of millions of dollars in lost government support, vanishing vessel orders, and an uncertain future for the billions of dollars worth of investments. The impact represents an unintended consequence of Trump's policy on the offshore wind industry, which has included a stop work orders and permit reviews for massive projects that were spurred by former President Joe Biden's green investment policy. Trump calls offshore wind an unsightly and inefficient technology that harms whales and birds. But he is also a huge supporter of U.S. maritime industries that he views as crucial in the global competition for trade and military dominance of the high seas. He has a counterproductive argument, said Joe Orgeron, a Republican Louisiana state representative and former offshore vessel business owner, who pointed out the offshore wind industry was responsible for many ship orders in recent years. That all came to a sudden halt, unfortunately. Reuters interviewed 13 port representatives, shipbuilders, and trade groups, who detailed the impact of Trump's policy moves targeting offshore wind. The impacts include more than $679 million worth of canceled Department of Transportation financing for ports to support offshore wind. Meanwhile, orders for new offshore wind service vessels designed to carry workers and huge turbines offshore or to lay undersea cable have also disappeared, according to trade group Oceanic Network, following a busy 2024 that saw the launch of at least 10 U.S. vessels built to serve offshore wind. Existing vessels are also being sold off or considered for redeployment to other global regions, according to reporting. Oceanic estimates last year that more than two dozen U.S. ports were pursuing offshore wind projects. Many of those lost crucial funding after the DOT canceled 12 grants worth $679 million in August. The Trump administration said it can revive the U.S. shipbuilding and port industry, which has suffered from years of cost inflation and a dearth of government support, without offshore wind support. Big cancellation. Danish shipping giant Maersk canceled a $475 million contract earlier in October for a ship that was custom designed to install massive turbines at the Empire Wind Project off the coast of New York, laying bare the downturn in vessel demand. Equinor's Empire Wind had been embroiled in Trump's opposition to offshore wind earlier this year, when the administration issued a stop work order that delayed its construction for a month. The ship's builder, Singapore-based Seatrium, said it was evaluating its options for the vessel, which was nearly fully built and could take legal action. Offshore wind's rise in the Northeast in recent years had fueled robust demand for many such vessels, including several built in U.S. shipyards or flying U.S. flags, according to Oceanic. It said the sector cumulatively has attracted $5.1 billion in port investments and $1.8 billion in vessel orders. Among the vessels built is the $715 million Charybdis, the only U.S.-flagged wind turbine installation vessel, which is now working on Dominion Energy's Coastal Virginia offshore wind project. Louisiana Edison Coast also built two major offshore worker housing vessels for Equinor and Ørsted projects currently under construction, but that work is drying up. Offshore wind developer U.S. Wind said in court documents filed earlier in October it had been on track to secure specialized vessels for offshore wind installation, but the Trump administration's efforts to stop its Maryland project had disrupted that progress. Such vessels are scarce and booked years in advance, requiring early action to meet construction timelines, the company said. Rhode Island's Blount Boats, which began building crew transfer vessels for offshore wind in 2016, said it had stopped completely. Meanwhile, some existing vessels serving offshore wind are being sold off. Houston-based Secor Marine announced in August it would sell two U.S.-flagged lift boats used on the Block Island and South Fork offshore wind farms to Nigerian oil and gas services company JAD Construction for $74 million, citing delays and cancellations. Ports are reeling too. Oceanic estimated last year that more than two dozen U.S. ports were pursuing offshore wind projects. Many of those lost critical funding after the DOT canceled 12 grants worth $679 million in August, hitting projects in states including Massachusetts, New York, California, Maryland, and Virginia. It's realistic to look at the current landscape and see that this industry is going to be deeply challenged by the current administration, said Salem, Massachusetts Mayor Dominic Pangallo, whose city's port project is struggling after a funding cancellation. In Northern California, the Humboldt Bay offshore wind port that lost $426.7 million is expected to be delayed by about 5 years to at least 2035, according to Chris Mickelson, executive director of the Humboldt Bay Harbor Recreation and Conservation District. The project is hoping to be able to tap funds from a state climate bond to make up for the lost federal money. In Norfolk, Virginia, the developer of a marine logistics terminal that lost a $39 million DOT grant submitted a revised proposal refocusing the project away from offshore wind to align with the administration's priorities, city economic development officials said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. East River Road Rehab Project completed. Jeannie Shields from the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. City officials announce the completion of an $8.1 million 2-year rehabilitation project on the intersection of East River Road and Farnham Lane, outside of Rochester Institute of Technology. City officials last week announced the completion of a 2-year rehabilitation project on East River Road. The $8.1 million project began in April 2024 and spans from Ward Road to Interstate 90. Project goals included improving safety and traffic flow for area pedestrians, cyclists, and motorists. Other project features include road widening, installation of a new storm sewer, construction of a multi-use asphalt trail, replacement of traffic signals, signs, and pavement markings, milling and repaving of the highway surface. City officials have been working the Rochester Institute of Technology to assure the safety for students as they commute to and from campus. With the assistance of RIT, a 1.75 mile long multimodal path has been installed to allow students living off campus to commute to the university safely, said Monroe County Executive Adam Bellow. Driver killed in crash into a tree identified by Victoria E. Feely, New York Connect team. The Monroe County Sheriff's Office has identified the man killed when he crashed into a tree in Chilai. Ted Carabinus, 57, of Rochester, died October 22nd when the SUV he was operating crashed into a tree on Sutherland Trail, a residential road, said Sheriff Spokesman Deputy David Marsucci. Carabinus, who was alone in the vehicle, was unresponsive when first responders arrived and was pronounced dead. The cause of the collision remains under investigation. Mertucci said, "Please keep the family and friends of the deceased in your thoughts during this difficult time for them," Mertucci said in a news release. Three seriously injured when car rear-ends horse-drawn buggy. Victoria E. Feely. Three people were seriously injured October 26th when a car rear-ended a horse-drawn buggy in Yates County, according to the Yates County Sheriff's Office. Deputies said the crash happened just after 2:30 p.m. on Six Corners Road in the town of Barrington. The buggy, driven by Daniel Nolt, 31, of Dundee, Yates County, was heading south when it was struck from behind by a car driven by a 38-year-old Dundee woman. The impact caused substantial damage to both the car and the buggy, investigators said. Nolt and two passengers, a 25-year-old woman and a child, were thrown from the buggy and suffered serious injuries. They were airlifted to Strong Memorial Hospital for treatment. Their current conditions are not immediately available. The driver of the car and her passenger, also a child, were not injured, according to deputies. The driver was ticketed for following too closely a traffic violation. Deputies did not say whether the horse was injured in the crash. The Yates County Sheriff's Office continues to investigate the incident. Man charged with murder and stabbing outside a Rondacoy lounge. New York Connect team. Police have arrested a Rochester man in connection with the fatal stabbing of Charles Wilson, Jr., 30, during an incident outside Lush Resto Lounge on East Ridge Road in Rondacoy. On October 24th, members of the U.S. Marshals Service and the Irondequoit Police Department took Nuri Simmons, 48, of Emerson Street into custody. Investigators said Simmons had been identified as a person of interest after reportedly arguing with Wilson inside the establishment before the stabbing. Police said Simmons was responsible for Wilson's death. He has been charged with second-degree murder and arraigned in Monroe County CAP court. The original incident occurred earlier this month when an Irondequoit police sergeant witnessed a disturbance outside the lounge at 527 East Ridge Road. During the altercation, Wilson crashed through a front plate glass window and was found suffering from a severe stab wound to his torso. He was transported to Strong Memorial Hospital, where he later died. Police previously said the establishment did not appear to have a valid New York State liquor license, and a separate town investigation into the venue's operations was ongoing. New York State Police and U.S. Marshals Service assisted in the investigation. Fairport seeks community input on downtown revitalization projects. Jeannie Shields. The village of Fairport is proposing a range of projects for its downtown revitalization initiative and is seeking residents' feedback through a public survey. Through the survey, residents and visitors can share their thoughts on the potential projects. Proposed projects include revitalization of Kennelly Park, infrastructure improvements for multimodal transportation, a boutique hotel. The village is also proposing a redevelopment project that will turn an unused industrial building located behind the cannery into a mixed-use residential and commercial building. As we fine-tune Fairport's DRI application, it is essential that we hear from the people who live, work, and spend time here, said Mayor Julie Demaratz in a press statement. The projects we put forward and the division that guides them must truly reflect the collective point of view of our community. Every response helps us ensure Fairport's future remains vibrant, inclusive, and connected. Residents and visitors can access the online survey until Friday, October 31st. The online survey can be found on the village's DRI website at www.fairportdri.com or fill out a paper copy available at the Fairport Public Library. Hochul on public safety tour in Rochester blasts ICE raids. Kayla Kane wrote this. During a public safety tour stop in Rochester on October 24th, Governor Kathy Hochul turned her attention to the federal government. President Donald Trump, she said, is wasting resources by enlisting FBI agents to carry out his mass deportation agenda and sending masked ICE agents after innocent individuals. The priority was supposed to be to go after the worst of the worst, the baddest of the bad, and that's not what we're seeing, Hochul said. We're not seeing it in the streets of Rochester. We're not seeing it in the rural farms and factories where the raids are occurring. We're not seeing it in the streets of New York. Hochul also went after Trump for attempting to cut $187 million in anti-terrorism funding for New York police agencies. The governor said the Monroe County Sheriff's Office would have lost $900,000 in funding for its bomb squads, tactical and canine units. Governor Kathy Hochul announces on October 23rd an $11.4 million investment in new law enforcement technology for police agencies across Westchester County. I've called up the president and said, "You really want to defund the police? Not a good look," Hochul said. Trump reversed the cuts earlier this month. Trump gets royal welcome in Japan. Trade truce with China in the works. President Donald Trump met with Japan's Emperor Naruhito at the Imperial Palace in Tokyo on October 27th. Trump arrived in Japan as the next leg of an Asian tour that could see trade negotiations with China. Upcoming dates. A timeline of upcoming dates and events that could have bearing on U.S. tariff policy. October 30th, Trump and Xi are to meet in South Korea, with expectations building that the discussions could pave the way for a potential trade deal. November 1st, a 25% tariff on all imported medium and heavy-duty trucks will take effect. Additional 100% tariffs on China's U.S.-bound exports will go into force, with new export controls on crucial software if the two countries do not reach a deal. January 1st, 2026, previously levied 25% duties will rise further to 30% for upholstered furniture and 50% for cabinets and vanities from countries without trade agreements. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 27th issue of the Democrat and Chronicle. Your reader has been Janice. Thank you for listening.